Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you all. Be seated, please. Thank you again. Warm welcome to the University of Idaho College of Law. And we are pleased to be able to hear our third case of February 11, 2026, a matter entitled Wade Alexander Best versus the State of Idaho, case number 53233. Mr. Best appeals and is represented by Andrea Reynolds, and the State of Idaho is represented by Kale Gans. Counsel, anything preliminary to your comments today?
There you go.
Very well. His room is.
May it please the court, counsel. In 2019, Mr. Best pled guilty under North Carolina v. Alford to a single charge of lewd conduct with a minor and was sentenced to a prison term of up to 20 years. By pleading guilty under Alford, Mr. Best did not admit that he committed the charged offense, but he did acknowledge the state had enough evidence to obtain a conviction, in large part based on the statements he made during a confrontation call with the alleged victim's mother. For the last 7 years, Mr. Best has been in prison, and he maintains his innocence to this day. Mr. Best appealed from his judgment of conviction, challenging his sentence as an abuse of discretion. The Court of Appeals affirmed. Mr. Best filed a petition for review, and this court denied that petition. In 2021, Mr. Best filed a pro se petition for post-conviction relief, raising 5 claims stemming from the proceedings in the trial court and raising multiple allegations of ineffective assistance of trial counsel. He asked the district court to allow him to withdraw his guilty plea and take the case to trial. The state filed a motion to summarily dismiss Mr. Best's petition, arguing he had not met his burden on his ineffective assistance of counsel claims. As the state concedes on appeal, the state did not address Mr. Best's trial-level claims in its motion for summary dismissal. In a rather unusual decision, Mr. Best's attorney did not file an opposition to the state's motion. Instead, he filed an affidavit for Mr. Best, providing additional factual support for his ineffective assistance of counsel claims. And he stipulated that the court could decide the motion on the pleadings and the affidavits in the record. The court did just that, granted the state's motion for summary dismissal. And this is the critical and, frankly, narrow reason we're before this court today. Even though the state's motion for summary dismissal only addressed some of Mr. Best's ineffective assistance of counsel claims, the district court dismissed his entire petition, including his trial-level claims. The court erred in doing so because it did not, give Mr. Best 20 days to respond to its proposed dismissal of the claims that were not addressed by the state, as required by Idaho Code, Section 4906, Subsection B. This appeal was initially assigned to the Court of Appeals, which held that the state's motion adequately addressed all of Mr. Best's claims and that Mr. Best failed to preserve his no-notice argument for appeal by failing to raise it in the district court. In so doing, the Court of Appeals, without invitation from the state, decided it was not bound to follow this court's decision in Kelly. While the petition for review in this case was pending, this court decided Bell versus State. That case is similar procedurally. However, there, Mr. Bell filed a motion for reconsideration in the district court, and this court held that where a petitioner files a motion to reconsider a grant of summary dismissal in the district court and fails to raise a no-notice argument in that motion, he cannot make a no-notice argument for the first time in appeal. This case is not controlled by Bell because Mr. Best did not file a motion to reconsider in the district court. This court should hold that a petitioner is not required to file a motion to reconsider in order to preserve a no-notice claim for appeal and should reaffirm that the statute means what it says. The district court is required to provide 20 days notice before sua sponte dismissing a petition for post-conviction relief. Mr. Best is entitled to remand. With that background, I think it's worth looking into the notice requirement. Idaho Code Section 19-4906C, or the 4906 as a whole, is titled Pleadings and Judgment on Pleadings. 4906 subsection C provides that a district court may grant the state's motion for summary disposition when it appears there are no genuine issues of material fact and the moving party is entitled to a judgment as a matter of law. That is where the state files a motion for summary disposition. The party has a chance, the petitioner has a chance to oppose that motion, present additional affidavits, factual support, and then this court can grant that motion if it decides the standard is met. Under subsection B of that statute, something unusual here, the district court can sua sponte dispose of a post-conviction petition. This is rare in the civil law for the court to do something without invitation from the parties, but it requires that the court provide the petitioner with 20 days to respond to the proposed dismissal. Where the state has filed a motion for summary disposition, but the court dismisses the application on grounds different from those asserted in the state's motion, the court does so on its own initiative and must provide that 20 days notice. That comes from this court's decision in, I don't know how to pronounce it, but I believe it's Sancomchone. You guys can correct me if that's wrong. So we have two different ways of getting rid of summarily getting rid of a petition. First, where the state files a motion, and second, where the court does that dismissal sua sponte. Then mixed, where the court does it partially on the grounds argued by the state and partially on its own. That notice is key, and that's, again, why we're here today. Mr. Best did not have notice that all of his claims should be dismissed or could be dismissed. The question of whether notice is sufficient is claim-specific. Under Duruchet, we know the moving party has to state with particularity the grounds for seeking summary dismissal. And if the argument is that an essential element of a claim is not supported by admissible evidence, the moving party only has to point that out. That is, the state doesn't have to say what evidence would be sufficient, but simply to point out that what they have is not enough. The key is that the notice is sufficient if the other party cannot assert surprise or prejudice as a result. And that's clearly what happened in this case. When Mr. Best received the state's motion for summary dismissal and the supporting memorandum, what did he do? He submitted an affidavit providing additional factual support for his ineffective assistance of counsel claims. He did not address the trial level claims. Those were not specifically addressed either in the motion or supporting memorandum. Those are the claims that he was surprised later that were dismissed by the district court without providing that notice. Preservation. This court said in Kelly that Duruchet does not preclude an appellant from asserting a claim of no notice for the first time in appeal. Kelly has repeatedly been cited for this proposition by this court and the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals was wrong to disavow Kelly in this case. This court does not require a party to preserve a challenge to an order they did not have notice of and could not anticipate. A couple contexts I can think of relevant to that, the attorney's fee context, restitution order. If the district court issues an order, again, that they weren't aware was coming, they don't have to preserve a challenge beyond just having a notice of appeal from that. And again, it's the whole point of notice. As stated in Duruchet, notice is sufficient if the non-moving party cannot assert surprise or prejudice. Here, there's nothing in the rules that would require Mr. Best to file a motion to reconsider in order to preserve his challenge. The district court is obligated by that statute to provide that 20 days notice. It did not do so. That's it. There's no concern about giving the district court a chance to address this in the first instance. The statute says what it says. Mr. Best was totally within his rights to file a notice of appeal and raise this for the first time on appeal. Could he have filed a motion to reconsider? Yes, we know that. There's a footnote in Kelly addressing that. We know that from Bell. Certainly, he could have filed a motion to reconsider. Had he done so, he would have had to raise this claim in order to preserve it for appeal. But this court has never said that a motion to reconsider is required. In fact, quite to the contrary, motions to reconsider are generally not required for preservation. We know this from In Re Guardianship of Doe, a case from 2014, where this court said that once the court has ruled, the guardians did not have to file a motion for reconsideration in order to preserve an issue for appeal. Parkside Schools versus Bronco Elite, a case from 2008, noting a motion for reconsideration might be a more prudent step, but was not required. Here, would it have been more prudent? Perhaps. Is it required? Well, the rules don't say that. The statute doesn't say that. This court has never held that. This case is simple. It's procedurally complex in that Mr. Best has been sitting in prison for a long time, and it's taken a long way to wind itself before this court today. But the issue is narrow and it's straightforward. Under the statute, the district court was required to give 20 days notice to Mr. Best before dismissing his trial level claims and the ineffective assistance of counsel claims that were not addressed by the state. It did not do so, and that's what we're asking for this case to go back for him to get that notice.
Just looking at Best and Bell,
yes.
Have we set, from your perspective, looking at the post-conviction world, has this court made it sufficiently clear as to what the preservation requirement is moving forward?
Well, I believe that this case is necessary to do that in order to hold that a motion for reconsideration is not required. I think that wasn't presented to the court in Bell, and so it's clear why the court didn't address it there. I do think that after this case, I think there is a case suspended pending the decision here, but I believe that will be resolved by this case here. I do think it's clear after this that a motion for reconsideration is not required and that the notice is required. Kelly is still good law. Again, that hasn't been abrogated, disavowed by anyone other than the court appeals. It's not asked for by opposing counsel here. So I don't see that there's outstanding issues there. I might have larger concerns about post-conviction, but no, I think that this hopefully is the sort of last piece of the puzzle, if you will, as to preservation for a no-notice argument.
I have a question for you. The state makes an interesting argument, and if I understand it, and if I don't, I trust Mr. Gans will correct that. But it is that with respect to the trial level claims, since they start off presumed forfeited because they could have been appealed, the onus was on Best in the first place to raise an issue about why he could not have brought them earlier. And so, if I understand this correctly, since they're forfeited, never were really part of the claim, and that's what Judge Buchanan said, they're not before me. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I read that argument similarly. The only section of the statute, the Uniform Post-Conviction Act, that allows for judgment on the pleadings is the one that I mentioned earlier, 19-4906. It does not talk about some claims being subject to any other type of dismissal other than the two methods indicated, a motion from the state or sua sponte by the court. I have never seen any other reason to say, well, the petitioner filed a petition, some claims were forfeited, couldn't have been brought in the first place or shouldn't have been brought in the first place. Ipso facto, we just pretend the petition doesn't exist. I mean, you'd have to dismiss it procedurally. It would have to be dismissed and judgment entered. The only avenue, the only mechanism for that is this statute. And the notice requirements come from the statute. Had the legislature wanted to provide a way to somehow impose an even higher burden, pleading burden. We already have a high pleading burden in post-conviction. They could have done that. There are so many hurdles to post-conviction, frankly, between time requirements, the burden and the pleadings, you know, the fact that this district court can sua sponte dismiss. I think reading that in from, as far as I can tell, nothing just doesn't make sense. And there's, again, no law that I know that would support that.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Hands when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This will be short, I promise. So, Mr. Best has failed to show that the district court sua sponte dismissed his trial error claims. It wasn't a sua sponte dismissal because the court's order was not so dissimilar from the state's motion that sought to dismiss the entire petition as a matter of law. And below, post-conviction counsel had a full opportunity to respond to the looming dismissal of the entire petition, but he stipulated that he had no response to give. So, in this case, it's important to note that the state moved to dismiss the petition in its entirety, right? So the state filed a motion for summary dismissal, not a motion for partial summary dismissal, not a motion for dismissal of claims 6 through 9, but a motion to dismiss the entire petition.
But the state only addressed the IEC claims, right?
Well, it only addressed those claims in detail. I will concede that point. But at the point that the state files that motion, Mr. Best is on notice that the entire petition is subject to dismissal, and the state has said that the entire petition is subject to dismissal as a matter of law.
Is the motion one that's sufficient to meet the criteria of Kelly that it's stated with particularity or specific, I guess it's particularity grounds therefore when they just say we want the whole thing dismissed, they go on and argue with particularity what the IAC claims were and don't even reference the trial or the claims that they were.
Well, you know, that's up for this court to decide, and I'm not going to push this point too hard, because if this court decides that, well, in order to, you know, have that 1949-01 dismissal be the basis for the court's dismissal, that it needs to be mentioned somewhere in the state's moving papers, maybe in the answer, maybe in the motion for summary dismissal, if that's what the state needed to do, the state didn't do that below. And so I can't stand before you and say otherwise, and that's where we're at. Now, one thing that I will sort of add to the pile of things to talk about here is I don't know that this court needs to change the standard or add a final piece of the puzzle here or really reinvent the wheel on whether or not something needs to be preserved below in terms of notice in order to assert it on appeal. And just I'll add my two cents here. This court has not talked about no notice claims. That's not something that this court has used as a term of art. That's what my friend is saying. Well, we're talking about no notice claims. Actually, there's two different kinds of claims that this court has talked about: sufficiency of notice and lack of notice. Now, Kelly talked about lack of notice, and lack of notice claims, it is true they can be heard for the first time on appeal. And so if this court says what we're talking about here is lack of notice, then it can be raised for the first time on appeal, and that's that. But this court has also held repeatedly that if the petitioner is asserting insufficient notice, then they do have to preserve that argument below.
None of those cases, though, were post-conviction relief cases, were they?
Kelly and
post-Kelly. I'm talking about like Taylor versus Taylor, Gordon versus Hendrick, some of the cases that the Court of Appeals mentioned in its opinion that suggest we've departed from the Kelly standard. None of those cases were post-conviction, were they?
Well, I don't believe that they were, and to be clear, I'm not advocating that this court take the Court of Appeals approach to resolving this. I'm just asking everybody to wind the clock back, go back to Kelly, go back to Desrochers, and you know the clear standard needs to be insufficient notice. You need to make the argument below. Lack of notice, you don't need to make the argument below.
So your position then, you're distinguishing it from the Court of Appeals opinion, which we're not reviewing, obviously, here.
Sure.
But you're distinguishing your position from their position in that they've suggested we somehow implicitly disavowed our own holding in Kelly. The state's not taking that position.
The state is not taking that position. And, you know, it's not my usual habit to criticize judges' opinions in public in front of a large audience. But if you look, for example, on page 12 of the Court of Appeals decision, they basically say that lack of notice claims need to be preserved below. But that's just not the standard. Lack of notice can be raised for the first time on appeal. Insufficient notice cannot. And
I
so
essentially the same argument, though. I mean, it's just the mechanism by which the motion proceeded below. Sufficiency of notice is, you may have moved to dismiss my whole thing, but you didn't, you only stated one basis and the court ruled on an entirely different basis. I mean, the heart of the argument is the same. I didn't know that my claims were subject to dismissal on this basis. And so why would we treat those two groups any differently when the argument is the same in both? I didn't know.
So I think here is why you would want to treat it differently. So here's an example of lack of notice. So if the state files a motion to summarily dismiss claims 1 through 5, and it doesn't say that it's a motion for summary dismissal, it says this is a motion for partial summary dismissal, and I want the court to dismiss half of the claims. Now, when post-conviction counsel gets those papers, he fully expects that they're going to be heading to an evidentiary hearing, you know, after this is all said and done, at least as to the second half of claims. And if the district court doesn't just grant partial summary dismissal, but dismisses the entire petition, in that circumstance, the petitioner could say, look, that is lack of notice. I had zero notice that the second half of claims were going to be dismissed as well. Insufficient notice is different. Insufficient notice is, let's say that the state files an answer, And the state has a little footnote, you know, on page 30 of its answer. I know you love footnotes, Justice Brody. And it's in point 8, and, you know, and it says something, the petition also fails because of 1949-01, period. And then the state never makes any more argument about that. It never applies that to, you know, the rest of the facts of the case. And then it says nothing about that in the motion for summary dismissal, but it's there, right? It's there. If you control F the record, you can find 1949-01. Now, if counsel on the other side, if post-conviction petitioner's counsel thought that that was insufficient, he has an obligation to raise that below because it's there. It's not zero notice, but he would say that doesn't sufficiently apprise us of what argument you're making, and you need to say more there. And they do need to say more below on the petitioner's side in order to preserve that for appeal. So that is the difference between
what
the two.
What is the source of the obligation of which you speak?
The source of the obligation.
You say counsel has an obligation to address it below. Where does that obligation come from?
From this court and this court's preservation doctrine.
You're saying there's an obligation to file a motion for reconsideration?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that you have to bring it up at some point in the proceedings. So if there is a hearing on the state's motion for partial summary dismissal, and you want to say that the notice that I got on this claim is insufficient, you need to bring that up at the hearing. If you want to respond to the state's motion for summary dismissal, you need to say you have not sufficiently articulated why you think this thing is subject to dismissal for this reason.
And what about when you have the footnote in the state's brief, you have the hearing, the state doesn't argue anything about 1949-01, and the district court says, I'm not going to reach, you know, the state's argument. I like the footnote. I'm going to dismiss it on 1949-01. To Justice Mueller's point, it seems like what you're arguing is they have an obligation to file a motion to reconsider in one instance and not in the other.
What I'm saying is they have an obligation at that hearing when the state stands up and gives its piece and says, here is why the thing needs to be dismissed. The petitioner's counsel needs to stand up and say, hey, I did not get enough notice, and the moving papers from the state are not giving us any notice of why does the statutory bar apply here? And by the way, the state didn't say anything about it at the hearing court, so that's not enough notice either. That's what I'm saying, that the post-conviction petitioner's attorney has an obligation to say that below and bring that up, because they have some notice, but they're arguing it's insufficient. And that's very different from just saying I had zero notice whatsoever that this was even an issue that was going to come up.
And I'm struggling with that because the very heart of insufficient notice is I didn't know. I didn't know until after the thing happened that this was going to be a basis. And so because the way I'm taking your argument is now every petitioner's counsel has an obligation to read the state's motion for summary dismissal or read the district court's notice of intent to dismiss and ferret out every possible argument and then say at the hearing, okay, I know this is what you really talked about, but to cover my bases, I didn't get notice on this or this or this or this. I just don't, it doesn't seem reasonable to me that we're going to put that obligation on a petitioner's counsel.
You do not have an obligation to say, I did not get notice on this, right? Because it wasn't asserted. It's not there. So there is no obligation for the petitioner to say, I had zero notice on this thing. But by necessity, if someone is saying, I had insufficient notice of 1949-01, well, the only way you could possibly say I had insufficient notice of the thing is if the thing was in the state's moving papers. So that's his claim. If we're in the situation where we're talking about insufficient notice, the only coherent way to talk about this is to say, well, you're saying that you did have notice, but it wasn't sufficient. And that's different than saying the notice was just non-existent from the get-go.
But then that necessarily requires us to apply that rule to go through cases and say, do we think there was any notice given or no notice given? And now whether you needed to preserve below or not is going to depend on whether we think the footnote was notice of an argument or whether the footnote was just an errant reference that wasn't tied to anything else.
And I understand that, but I think this court is completely capable of doing that work. You have to do that work anytime you review a preservation argument. I know you hate preservation now, and that's fine. but, you know, anytime you have to determine whether or not something is preserved, you have to go through the record and you have to ask yourself, well, is this footnote enough, right? Is it enough that it's in a footnote, or does it need to be in a paragraph in the main text? It's just that's a judgment call that this court is able to make, I'm sure.
I don't know if we hate.
I know. I was being hyperbolic. No, I was trying.
I'm going to engage with you on that. For
sure,
second.
Sure.
It seems to me we have a pendulum that goes to one extreme and the other, and it seems like as soon as we make a ruling one way, it gets taken by the state as far as it possibly can. If we make a ruling another way, it gets taken by the defense as far. That's how the adversarial process. We're trying to find the Goldilocks spot where it's just right. Help me understand why where it's been set by the Court of Appeals, in their opinion, is just right.
Well, again, these are two separate things. And I consider myself a veteran of the preservation wars. You know, I was there in 2017 when Garcia Rodriguez was decided. And I was there for Wolf and Rodriguez and Rodriguez Jr., all of those cases. And, you know, it is what it is. I think you noted it's an adversarial system. So I bet our side and the other side, we wish we could just find a case where we could come together and agree, like, maybe the preservation rules should be relaxed a little bit.
I would love to hear you sing Kumbaya.
Let's do it. We're, yeah. But I can't speak on behalf of my friend, but I think the state, you know, is certainly, we would certainly be in favor of a relaxed preservation standard and the latitude for appellate attorneys to make the arguments on appeal. That aren't, you know, maybe aren't groomed horses. And so that's my view on preservation. As far as the Court of Appeals opinion, again, I think where the Court of Appeals went wrong is just departing from Kelly and Deroche. And again, I don't want this court to reinvent it. And if this court maybe doesn't want to add to the pile of decisions on preservation, the simple way to do it is just to say there is no new standard. Deroche and Kelly, those are the standard. There is a difference between lack of notice and insufficient notice. Let's just turn the clock back and get back to 2016 or whenever.
So let me ask you about sufficiency of notice, if that's what we want to call this. I recognize that the state's motion is a motion for summary disposition and asks for the entire petition to be dismissed because it fails to raise a genuine issue of material fact. The next paragraph of the motion says Best's ineffective assistance of counsel claims fail to raise a genuine issue of material fact regarding both deficient performance of trial counsel and resulting prejudice. Don't we have to look at the entirety of the motion to decide whether any notice was provided of intent to seek dismissal of the trial-based claims? I mean, I recognize the state moved in the motion for complete dismissal, but the same motion only asks for dismissal of the ineffective assistance of counsel claims. It doesn't mention the trial claims at all.
I think that it does need to be read as a whole, and I think for me the most telling part is that the motion is a motion for summary dismissal of the petition. And at no point does the motion say this is for a partial summary dismissal and I'm seeking to, you know, dismiss only half the claims. But, you know, if you're willing to work with me on this insufficient notice, lack of notice thing, I would happily trade keeping those standards, even if we lose this case, because you say this is a case of lack of notice. I'm perfectly willing to say, okay, fine, it's a lack of notice case. Let's go back. Let's have the district court issue a new notice of intent to dismiss. But let's just keep Kelly, Deroche. Let's keep the standards.
If that's what works, then we're going to have every prosecutor in the state always filing a motion for full dismissal of the post-conviction relief action. We'll never see any again that's asked for just partial dismissal. If just asking to have the whole thing deleted is all that's dismissed is all that's necessary, then we're going to be taking the nuance out of these and just treating them like all you have to do is ask for everything.
I mean, that's a possible side effect of going down that path. I mean, but again, if I don't have much more to say on the merits of this case. If this court says, look, this is lack of notice, so it is preserved, but this court keeps the framework in place of the difference between lack of notice and insufficient notice, then that is what it is.
I guess my concern is we could turn this from an issue, a situation where we prefer prosecutors to use a scalpel. Instead, we're going to be giving them carte blanche to use a chainsaw.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I prefer, I always prefer the most tailored, you know, narrow sort of dismissal motion that the prosecutor can give. And it is what it is. I mean, I don't know that I have anything to add on that point. Okay, I do.
Before we leave the
topic,
so in Bell, did we articulate the standard in a manner that is commensurate with what you're advocating for here today? Or did we say something in Bell that in your mind gets us off track from where we ought to be?
I don't think that Bell, I'll just tell you my view of it. I don't think that Bell turned on the lack of notice, insufficient notice distinction. I think what it turned on is the fact that there was a motion filed that said, hey, I didn't have notice for the dismissal of claims 1 through 3, but then the appeal said, hey, I didn't have notice of claims 4 through 6. And from the state's perspective, that's, you know, pretty just well established. That's a preservation rule I think we can all live with, which is that if you file a motion below and you make assertions below going to one set of claims, you don't get to turn around on appeal and apply those to a different set of claims. So short answer, no, I don't think that Bell departed from what I think is sort of the sensible preservation in post-conviction scheme that this court has had. Okay, I have one last point of housekeeping, which is what claims will be decided on remand? I know this is boring, but I got to do this. So the district court found that the petition alleged 4 IAC claims. 4, that's it. And my friend said on page 4 of the opening brief that the district court recognized that Mr. Best alleged his trial counsel was ineffective in 1, 2, 3, 4. 4 claims, period. Now, you might say, well, maybe that was just a typo. Maybe they thought there were more claims than that. But then the exact same paragraph, verbatim on page 8, says, same thing. District court recognized that Mr. Best alleged his trial counsel was ineffective in 1, 2, 3, 4. And so we said in our respondents brief, we agreed. There were 4 claims, and we think that the state's moving papers gave notice for all 4, including this purported plea agreement negotiation violation claim. And so we say the dismissal order should be affirmed as to those claims. But then in the reply brief, my friend has said that actually there were a bunch of other IAC claims. There's a mitigation claim, there's a Rule 608 claim, all these other claims that are there. And I would just ask this court to say that if you know, the appellant disagrees with the district court's construction of claims, then they should say that before the reply brief. And because the opening brief only talked about 4 ineffective assistance of counsel claims, there should be no additional claims that are smuggled in that kind of ride along on the remand that the state now has to deal with below. All of them should be dismissed, and there were only 4 of them. And that's all I got. I welcome this court's questions.
Thank you. Madam Clerk, how much time do we have?
17 minutes.
Thank you.
I'm going to start just briefly with the relief requested. Appellant's brief, page 8, makes clear this court must vacate the judgment denying Mr. Best's petition and remand this case to the district court for further proceedings on all of his claims, with the exception of the 3 ineffective assistance of counsel claims on which he received the statutorily required notice. Page 9 of the appellant's brief, in the conclusion section, asks the court to remand the case back to district court for further proceedings as to all of the claims he raised in the petition, with the exception of the 3 ineffective assistance of counsel claims that the estate addressed in its motion. It's clear from the appellant's brief, as I read it, from those sections I just highlighted, that what Mr. Best seeks on remand is notice as to all of the claims not specifically addressed in the state's motion. Again, all but the 3 IAC claims not specifically addressed in the state's motion, he has notice of the district court's intent to sua sponte dismiss those claims. In the reply brief, I do articulate what those claims are in more detail, but it certainly was within the appellant's brief. I think it's incorrect to say otherwise. It does bring me to a concern. Often with pro se petitions, this petition was not amended after counsel was appointed. often with pro se petitions, that figuring out the claims can be challenging. The district courts, I think this court is aware and has discussed before, that it puts the district court sometimes in a difficult position. So what should the court do in an instance like this? I think the district court can say in its order granting the state's motion for summary dismissal, also providing notice of intent to dismiss as to all other claims addressed by the petitioner. So the district court can make clear whether we're talking about three claims or five claims or 10 claims, on this page or this page, we give notice, the court gives notice of intent to dismiss all of those claims and 20 days to respond. Does that make sense as to the scope there? So what I am asking, again, in the appellant's brief, in the reply brief, for remand, for notice as to all of the claims apart from the three specifically addressed by the state in its motion.
As to those three claims, and maybe responding a little bit to Mr. Don's last comments to us, could it not be argued that the district judge was aware of all those and impliedly threw them out and gave notice of it when she highlighted in her decision the colloquy that took place during the guilty plea that was entered, when the Alford plea was entered? Your client was asked, you're represented by Ms. Jensen, and by the way, the judge put this in bold in her opinion, in her decision, are you satisfied with the representation? Answer, absolutely. Didn't say yes, didn't say sure, said absolutely. I'm just wondering, after a statement like that, cited in bold by the district judge at page 10 of her decision, anyone could have any lack of notice that the trial related, the claims related prior to the conviction had no basis to stand.
I think that, well, the district court specifically identified four ineffective assistance of counsel claims, as I recall. The failing to adequately review the terms of the Alford plea and coercing Mr. Best to agree to it, failing to suppress the confrontation call, negotiating a plea agreement that violated a prior plea agreement, and failing to devote sufficient time to that case. Certainly the district court was well aware of the underlying case, did quote from it extensively, took judicial notice of the entire record of that case. Whether the district court was aware of all of the other ineffective assistance of counsel claims asserted by Mr. Best, they're not specifically addressed. His petition is long and has many attachments. Whether, if the court intended to dismiss those all, what I was saying earlier, to the extent that it's difficult for the court, I'm not trying to put a higher burden on the court. I think the court had an obligation to say, you know, I hereby give notice that all of the claims asserted by Mr. Best in this petition are subject to summary dismissal, sua sponte, and Mr. Best has 20 days notice to respond.
So you're suggesting that at best, the court's focus on that only addressed whether or not the plea was entered freely and voluntarily and didn't at all cover any of the other issues that were related to the representation at the trial stage?
I think it could be read to that, but the court didn't even identify those as claims that were out there. So as I read it, there were 5 additional ineffective assistance of counsel claims that the court didn't acknowledge had even been alleged by Mr. Best. So all the court would have had to do, again, is the same factual background, the same recitation of the record, is say, I grant the state's motion for summary disposition, and to all the claims not addressed herein, this order shall serve as notice pursuant to the statute. Mr. Best has 20 days to respond, providing additional evidentiary support for all claims not addressed by the state.
So let me read what the conclusion of the district court
was. Yep.
And again, I want you to prevent me from reading too much into this.
Okay? Yeah.
The district court said the colloquy between the court and Best constitutes a prima facie showing that the plea was voluntary and knowing. Best's own sworn statements that he absolutely pleased, that he fully understood the plea agreement, that he was not being coerced to enter into the agreement, and he thought, and that he had enough time to talk to his attorney and was satisfied with her representation, are undisputed facts in the record that that Best claimed that his pleas were not, disproved the claims that Best claimed that the pleas were not knowing and voluntary. The record shows that the state fully abided by the terms. There is absolutely no evidence in the record to support Best's conclusory allegations that his plea was not knowing and voluntary. Best's claim of coercion and lack of understanding is disproved by the record and will be dismissed. Within that statement is a finding that he was pleased and that the undisputed facts in the record show that.
But the very statement you just recited goes to whether the plea was knowing and voluntary and whether he was coerced into making that plea. And that's certainly one of his largest ineffective assistance of counsel claims. But his other ones, trial counsel failed to interview the alleged victim and her family. Trial counsel failed to present any evidence regarding Mr. Best's relationship with the alleged victim. Trial counsel did not make certain arguments in mitigation at sentencing. Trial counsel withheld playing the recording of the confrontation call to Mr. Best. And trial counsel did not submit forms under either rule of evidence 608 or 404B, which allowed his character to be used as evidence against him. None of that are addressed therein.
I agree with you. But the court's finding that he was satisfied with her representation would suggest that everything that happened in the case happened with his satisfaction.
Well, Your Honor,
and
I think
that would include those things. So that's what I'm... Is that a bridge I shouldn't cross?
It is a bridge you shouldn't cross, and I think there's certainly a material issue of fact there. His the petition, the second affidavit, make clear that he strongly contests whether he was satisfied with his attorney's representation of him. So to the extent there's a dispute, certainly the district court's pointed to his statement that he was satisfied at the time of the change of plea, and he's now saying, I wasn't satisfied, all of these additional factual allegations. That's exactly
what you just said
why.
Right there is what gives me a problem. He said he was absolutely satisfied
at the change
until
of
he wasn't satisfied.
And right.
I'm just wondering if a defendant can have it both ways.
Well, that's for the court to resolve in post-conviction. So that's a disputed issue of material fact, and that's what should not be kicked summarily. So would he ultimately succeed on this claim? All of the IAC claims, I don't know. That was never resolved through evidentiary hearing. We do have an affidavit from Ms. Jensen in the record. We have multiple affidavits from Mr. Best. That is a question. That is precisely why summary disposition perhaps should have been given as any of those IAC claims. But he did present that evidence, and the court resolved it.
I guess when I look at the district court's decision on the IEC claims, I mean, it looks to me like there's specific claims, for example, that trial counsel withheld playing the recording of the confrontation call, those kinds of things. It seemed to me were dealt with maybe somewhat summarily, but sort of all fell into the category of the district court's rejection of the assertion that counsel wasn't prepared for trial or didn't adequately defend the case. I mean, I took it that the district court really did address those issues.
Well, the district court doesn't even identify those as a basis for the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. So I think that's, again, a challenge we have here with pro se petitions in general. There are a lot more claims the district court doesn't even identify. The district court lists, we have these claims and we have these claims. We have these, I believe, five trial level claims and we have these IAC claims. There were far more claims of ineffective assistance of counsel that the court didn't address. And again, I think we're just asking for notice. So if it's not clear whether the court included these, saw them, understood them, all the court needed to do is say, I grant the state's motion for summary dismissal, and to the extent there are unaddressed claims, I give Mr. Best 20 days notice to respond. It's we're not asking, you know, for an ultimate win at this point, or even to get right to an evidentiary hearing. But if we're debating back and forth, were these addressed, weren't they addressed, are they covered by this bolded language, are they not covered, can he change his mind, can he not, well, which one do we weigh? That's not the point at this stage. So, again, now that does bring us to sort of the narrow nature of this appeal and the narrow relief that we request, which is to go back for notice on those claims, on all of the claims that weren't specifically addressed. Just a couple other points, unless there's questions on that. Justice Mueller, you had talked about the Court of Appeals cases, asking if any of them are from post-conviction, post-Kelly. They are not. Taylor versus Taylor. This court held in a contract case that the argument that paragraph was a forfeiture provision was not preserved for appeal. This court held in Gordon versus Hedrick, a family law case. This court declined to address the constitutional argument raised for the first time on appeal, but the district court's decision affected the defendant's liberty interest. The other case cited by the Court of Appeals was Needs versus Hebner. That was a Court of Appeals case. The Court of Appeals said it declined to consider a claim of error involving the giving of preliminary oral instructions to the jury. So none of those were post-conviction cases. No case from this court that I'm aware of has called Kelly into question. And again, it wasn't argued by the state in Bell or in this case. Opposing counsel talked about the distinction, or I think challenged my use of the term no notice. I think by no notice, I mean lack of notice. To the extent that that's not clear, I apologize. I am distinguishing between no notice claims and sufficiency of notice claims. That's clear from the case law. Justice Bevin, you talked about the requirement that the basis for dismissal be stated with particularity. And I think that does bring me also to Justice Mueller's concern that you mentioned. If it's enough to simply cite the statute, cite the controlling law. That's what we would see in every single post-conviction case. A motion caption, motion for summary dismissal, and here are the legal standards governing it. Cite to the statute. That's it. There would be no claim-by-claim analysis. That would be enough to kick it. So again, if that's not the kind of notice that allows the fair response, allows the petitioner to come forward with additional factual evidence. The heart of insufficient notice, as you said, Justice Ahn, is I didn't know. And that's exactly what we have here. Mr. Best saying, I didn't know that all of my claims were going to go out. I knew the ineffective assistance of counsel claims specifically addressed were going to go out. That's why I submitted that affidavit with additional factual support. So I do worry that this case has, despite being narrow, it does have broad implications for what summary dismissal of post-conviction will look like. And with a larger concern that I have, that already post-conviction is dealt with summarily, and it's very, very hard to get relief. So if there are no further questions, I would ask this court to vacate the judgment dismissing Mr. Best's petition with prejudice, vacate the district court's order granting summary judgment, or summary dismissal of the petition, and remand this case to the district court with instructions that the court give notice of its intent to dismiss all of the claims not specifically addressed by the state. Thank you.
Thank you. To each of you, we appreciate your argument. This matter is under advisement. We will render a decision in due course. That's my understanding. We'll meet with counsel just briefly and then be back here for our Q&A for 45 minutes.
All rise.